history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some people around you with some incredible stories to tell. And we'll never know unless we ask a few questions and take that time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, we're going to meet a gentleman named George Poplin, 93 years old, lives in Central California now, but originally from Meeker, Oklahoma. How big a place was Meeker, Oklahoma?
Now there's 1,000, but when I was growing up, there were 500.
500 people.
27 seniors graduated with me.
So growing up in a town of 500 with three older sisters, what kind of things were you up to as a boy?
We played a lot of hide and seek. Also took corn cobs and put a feather in them and then threw them over the top of the barn to the other side of where the other group were.
And what, you're seeing if it lands on somebody's head or what?
Yeah.
Were there a lot of corn cobs to go around?
Well, yeah. We had two horses, and so they ate a lot of corn. My dad had a 57-acre ranch, and he had about 7 acres of corn, 7 of cotton, and about 3 other products. So we had plenty to keep busy.
You probably had a lot of chores to do.
I did have. Well, we had 500 chickens,
ooh,
hens. When Dad started, he started out with one incubator and was selling baby chickens, buying eggs from people and selling the baby chicken. Then he got two incubators in a bigger building and started handling some feed. Then he moved down on Main Street, because this was at our home, and we were on the end of the block.
Was your job collecting the eggs, or what'd you have to do?
We did everything. You collect the eggs, you carry water to them, feed them.
I would imagine that amount of chickens probably leaves quite a mess to clean up, too. Did you have to clean all that stuff up?
Yeah, you had lumber for them to stand on. They crapped down through that, and you had to scrape it out with a hoe.
That must have been a fun job.
Oh, yeah. I didn't do a whole lot of that. My sisters did, but my asthma kept me from doing some of those things.
Likely story. Sounds like a convenient excuse.
It helped.
Every generation probably has its own unique game that kids play growing up, but I'm interested in this game of throwing the corn cobs over to the other side of the barn. Why'd you put a feather in it? Did that help the aerodynamics?
It made it go straight.
So you'd throw a spiral?
Yeah.
Like a football?
Yeah.
That was my question. Do they go farther with a spiral, or if you throw them end over end like
no,
a tomahawk?
You throw a spiral.
Yeah?
You put the feather in there to guide them. They'll go straight instead of wobbly.
And this are chicken feathers or what?
Yeah.
So what does it feel like if you get hit in the head with a spiraling corn cob from the other side of the barn?
It wasn't very funny. So you dodged.
Anything to keep yourself occupied. Huh?
Yeah.
Did you notice a difference when the Great Depression hit? I mean, you've got all that livestock and all that produce. Did that take a hit during the Depression?
Not as bad as other things. Of course, what caused it in our area was the dust storms. Out in western Oklahoma, there was dust piled around a barbed wire fence, clear up over it. The fence caught the dust, and it all landed there, and you still can see it if you drive down through western Oklahoma.
Well, and so many people left Oklahoma in those years because of that.
Yeah.
But you guys had enough business to stay put?
Yeah. Or didn't have enough money to leave. I don't know which it was. We were pretty well established.
Do you remember in those years as a boy, do you remember having a dream, an ambition, thinking to yourself, hey, someday this is what I'm going to do?
Yeah, I was going to be a county agent.
Why is that?
They worked with the 4-H clubs and the farms and advised farmers and stuff. That's where I was going, Stillwater, Oklahoma. But I didn't get there.
Well, Uncle Sam had some other plans for you, and we're going to hear about that. But I'm just wondering, I'm trying to imagine myself in your shoes. And if you had three older sisters, and the oldest one 17 years older than you, did they come up with any plans for you? Did they try to manipulate you?
No.
didn't get you any hot water?
A funny thing, I went to the store. When I come back from service, I was over at my older sister's house. Mm-hmm. I went with her to the store, and somebody there asked her, "Is that your son?" Well, it's 17 years different.
Sure. I'm sure you never let her forget that either.
No.
Well, and you mentioned the asthma. How old were you when that came on? How big of an issue was it for you? How much did it hold you back?
It held me back a lot. I couldn't run very far, get out of breath. The medicine they had then for asthma was some kind of a powder, and you put it on a tin plate and set it on fire, and you put a funnel over it, and you breathe that smoke.
Wow.
That's supposed to give relief. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it did, but that was the only thing I knew of.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk about the asthma and what that meant for your potential in the service. But before you graduated high school, I guess it would have been your senior year in high school. Something happened that everybody seems to remember. December 7th, 1941?
I had won a trip to Chicago with the 4-H Club.
Uh-huh.
I got home on the 6th of December, and downtown on Sunday afternoon of the 7th, somebody heard it on the car radio, I guess it was. But we didn't have rush radios in those days. My dad had a radio, and he had electricity put into the house for the radio. The rest of our lights were gas lights.
When you heard that news about Pearl Harbor, did you understand it? Could you grasp what had happened out there?
Not really, because, you know, you had no TV. It wasn't like if you'd have been in California. I mean, it was a distance from us. And then they started drafting boys, and some of the high school kids went in. I did not. I stayed there and helped Dad. Then when Mom passed away, I lost that.
Let's talk about that. So your mother was ill for a while.
5 years. Breast cancer, but she wouldn't have it operated on. I only knew one other person in our area who had cancer at that time. It just was not a common thing like it is today.
So when they're starting to draft young men from your town, you have an exemption because you're needed on the ranch and your mother's sick, and then also because of the asthma? Or you were told that you were 4F because of the asthma?
Then when I was drafted, I went to the Oklahoma City to the board up there, and they give you an examination. Generally, they looked in one ear, and if they could see out the other one, you was okay. But they asked me when I was being checked, my blood pressure was high. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Well, why don't you eat lunch and come back after lunch, and we'll check it again." And I did, and he checked it, and he said, "Do you really want to go in the service?" I said, "I sure do." So I didn't have any high blood pressure. 3 weeks after starting training, I went to the doctors to see if I had high blood pressure. No, I didn't have a drop.
And so people understand the situation with your mother. As long as she was living.
Right.
But once she passed, obviously that exemption's gone.
Gone.
So then you get drafted. But you had been told, by a doctor that they probably wouldn't take you because of the asthma?
Yeah.
But when they needed bodies, they needed bodies.
That's right.
And there was something else that had happened in your life right before that. Didn't you get married right before you got drafted?
I got married 3 weeks before I was drafted.
So that was a short-lived honeymoon, huh?
Very short.
So you were, 19 years old when you got married?
20.
Uh-huh.
She was 16.
16 years old. Is there more of a story there that we should hear about?
Well, we struck it off pretty good.
How did her father feel about you?
You know, I went in, and he was a honorary character. They were already in bed, and I went into the bedroom and asked him if I could marry Pearlie. And he said yes, which just about knocked me over.
So you did. So you'd lost your mother, and not long after, you find a wife. A teenage bride, and you're married, and then you get the news that you're drafted.
Well, I knew I was going to be drafted.
You knew that was coming. Did she know that was
coming?
Yeah. Was there part of you that said, "Hey, if I get into this war, I might not ever see her again"?
Well, I went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and we left from there to Anniston, Alabama for training. She came down for about half of that time. We had a rented room in a house, somebody's house, and I'd go home whenever I could. I had a pretty good sergeant, so I did all right on that. But then we went home for 2 weeks for Thanksgiving, and I left to go to Fort Meade, Maryland. And from that time on, I never heard from her.
The whole time you were overseas?
The whole time, until I got back in the States. And that gives your system a shock. You say, is she pregnant? I don't know.
Has she found somebody else?
Well, I didn't think about that.
That happened to a lot of guys in the world.
I know it did. I know it did. When we were in the hospital, a guy got a Dear John letter from his girlfriend. He couldn't write. And so two or three of us composed a letter to her. It was funny. I bet she burned when she got it.
So when you were drafted, and you said you went in for the physical, and they said you had high blood pressure, and then they asked you if you really wanted to go, and you said yes, so they looked the other way. What was it that made you want to go so bad? Why was that important to you?
Well, because all the other guys were going. You didn't want to be a 4F-er.
Did you have any clue what to expect, what it was going to be like?
Are you kidding? And my first day, when I went to Fort Sill, a soldier, one that was there, cornered me, and he said, I've got a letter here. And he said, I can't read. Now, they drafted him, and he couldn't read. And then I had one taking care of me in the hospital that couldn't read.
What were your expectations? What did you think Army life was going to be like?
I had no clue. You know, we had no TV. When they had the big fights, everybody gathered around the radio and listened to the fight.
The boxing matches? Joe Louis and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Was there anything in the process of your training that was particularly difficult or challenging or made you wonder what you got into?
The worst part was the cross-country running. Now, the short exercises, I had no problem with them. But when I'd get to run, I'd get out of breath.
Because of the asthma?
I guess.
And how long was it from the time you started training to the time they sent you overseas?
We were training 17 weeks.
Uh-huh.
Went home for 2 weeks, then went up. It took us about 2 weeks to get up to Taunton, Massachusetts, where we got on the USS Mount Vernon ship and sailed to England.
Had you ever been on a ship before?
No.
How'd you take to it?
It was all right.
Didn't get seasick or anything?
Well, no. The night before we went, boy and I went to town. Of course, he didn't have any money. And I bought 2/5 of whiskey. There were no bars to drink in. So we went out behind the building and drank one of those quarts. And then my memory left me.
Woke up on the ship or what?
Well, no, I come too quicker than that. But 3 days out, there was a couple of guys. We had to eat standing up. You know, I had like a tray across through there. And these two guys looked at me and started laughing. And I said, what the blank are you laughing about? They said, well, you're the guy that we helped put on the bus to go back to base, and you didn't know it. My pants were black from here down where I vomited.
Wow. Did you learn a lesson there?
Oh, yeah. I learned I couldn't drink.
Well, I guess if they hadn't helped you, you wouldn't have been on the ship probably, huh?
That's probably true.
This was December?
December. We were in a palace in Givet, France. The palace bordered on one side to France, the other side to Belgium.
Uh-huh.
On Christmas Eve. And we were staying there to get ready to go out to our units.
Did you know what kind of unit you were going to be in?
Had no clue.
Wherever they send you.
Where we were on Christmas Eve, they gave us a rifle, a carbine, to clean. Now, they come gummed, and then you had to clean them before you can use them.
Right.
Then they took them back and gave them to officers, and they gave us a big gun to carry. No pistols, just M1.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm interested in, if you can remember any of this, as you're heading over. Again, you're a 20-year-old kid. You just got married. Your wife is staying in the States, and you're heading overseas and going to be risking your life. Do you remember experiencing anxiety or fear or concern that you might not make it back?
Well, they gave me a little Bible from the Gideons. I was passing them out, and I've still got it. I read quite a bit in that.
Is that something you kept in your uniform, in your pocket? Or?
Yeah. It was a New Testament type. It was very small.
Yep. So you get there, as you said. They take you toward the area where you're going to be fighting. But the guys that you're going to be serving with, did you know them at all? Or the guys you trained with?
No, we were divided up.
Because you're going to be replacements. And you're heading in all different directions to different units.
And the company I went into, I was there a couple of days, I guess. I became number 2 gunner because the guy that was carrying the gun, we had 30 caliber water-cooled machine gun,
uh-huh,
and 81-millimeter mortars. And then, of course, the shells for those things. So everybody worked on the crew.
Yeah.
The guy that got hit and I replaced came back. And, of course, I had to move back one. But the day I got hit, I've been on night duty, the last shift of the morning. So they brought hot breakfast to us, which we weren't used to having. When it was through, since I was already dressed, and, you know, this guy and I started carrying the cans back down to the Jeep, and that mortar shell hit in between us, and we split. He got hit in the chest. I got hit in the left hand, right arm, and my buttocks.
A lot of guys say that's the weapon, the enemy weapon they hated the most.
Yeah.
Because you didn't know when it was coming.
Well, if you heard it, it was going overhead. If you couldn't hear it, then when you get scared.
Mm-hmm. Were there mortar shells flying for a while before this one hit you? Did you know that
no.
this was happening?
In fact, the night before, there was a big hill in front of us, mm-hmm, cliff, and there was a white flag up there. So we assumed they were surrendering.
So you were really caught by surprise.
Yeah.
And we're going to hear more about the extent of those injuries, as well as his lengthy recovery, and the mindset that has helped him overcome those setbacks. Find photos of Mr. Poplin then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 93-year-old George Poplin of Clovis, California, originally from the small town of Meeker, Oklahoma. He spent all of 45 days in combat on a machine gun crew with Company H of the 9th Infantry Regiment, part of the 2nd Infantry Division in World War II. A German mortar shell cut short his time on the front lines and nearly claimed his life. But I want to get a little more about the time leading up to your injuries. You got there during the Battle of the Bulge and what they said was the most treacherous winter Europe had experienced in decades. I just can't imagine that winters in Oklahoma prepared you to face what you were dealing with there during the Bulge. So how'd you handle all of that?
Well, we had to thaw our machine guns out.
How'd you do that?
Now, it's just a saying. But they were water-cooled. You had the gun part, and you had the base, then you had the ammunition.
And you mentioned that you're part of this heavy weapons platoon, so you guys have the 81-millimeter mortars, you have these machine guns, and then there's different guys with different duties within that. Did you have to know everybody's job, or did you have one job that you did every day?
You just did one job.
And what was yours?
Carrying the ammunition, mostly, till I moved up to number two for a short time.
And just this idea of being a replacement, did that bother you at all, the thought that the reason they need replacements is guys are getting hit, guys are getting killed and injured?
Didn't think about it.
You never thought about the possibility that you might be hurt?
Well, when on Christmas Eve, I went to the chaplain's service, and I promised the Lord that if I got home, I'd serve him the rest of my life. That took a while for that to catch on, but I finally caught on after I got home.
But it sounds like you meant it when you said that, when you made that deal with God.
I did. Bless me, I did.
Is that to assume that you felt that wasn't exactly what you'd been doing before that? That this was going to be something new for you?
Yeah.
And when you're that far, when you're on the other side of the world and you know you're going to be in harm's way, you know, and it's Christmas, a time that you're used to spending with your family, what goes through your mind when you're instead with a bunch
Pretty
of...
Pretty sad.
Yeah? You think about home?
Oh, yeah.
Wonder what they're
and
eating there?
And from the time I left till I got back to the States, I didn't hear a word from home.
Not your father?
Not a letter caught up with me.
Wow. Even in the hospital, huh?
Mm-mm.
Wow. That must have made mail call hard when everybody else is getting it.
Oh, it was. When I got back to the States, the first thing I did was make a phone call to my wife.
Did she answer?
Yeah. See, we came into New York and shipped out to Texas.
I know we're bouncing around here. I'm just trying to make sure I don't miss anything along the way. What was your first taste of combat? I mean, you mentioned being in that castle on Christmas Eve. How soon after that did you start to get a feel for this?
This was the time that Patton had prayed for clear weather.
Uh-huh.
And we had 3 days of clear weather. And there were planes going over us and coming back all day long and all night.
The context there is that until that point, the weather's so bad, you guys are fighting on the ground, but the planes can't support you.
Planes couldn't go.
And can you give us a feel for what those combat conditions were? What you guys were up against, what, you know, from moment to moment, the kinds of things you were doing and what you had to watch out for?
Well, we had to be careful of light at night. One day, we were marching with Patton's tanks.
Uh-huh.
And they stopped to rest, and we pulled over and stopped to rest. We were walking. And I looked down at my foot, and here was a wire going over my foot.
One more step, huh?
And we eased out of there and got out of that place.
So you almost set off a booby trap or something?
Almost set off a booby trap.
Wow. And I imagine that as these days are going by, you're probably seeing a lot of things that you haven't seen before.
You might say that.
Can you give us a feel for that? The things that you were having to process and digest and make yourself aware of?
Well, it was just the way we had to eat and the way we had to walk. All we did was walk.
Did you have a lot of snow to walk through?
There was some snow.
Did you have to sleep in the snow?
Well, one night we were out on a kind of a rocky place. Every time we put a pick in the ground was frozen.
Mm-hmm.
So if you tried to pick, it sounded, made a big sound. Then here would come some artillery shells.
We're right over here, fire away.
I laid down there about 3 o'clock in the morning, I guess, and I would have been asleep in a minute. And the sergeant come over and kicked me and get me up. Because once you go to sleep, you'd be gone.
Because of how cold it was or because of the...
freeze.
Wow. And a lot of guys who were fighting in those conditions at that time suffered frozen feet?
Yeah, I did some of that. Not bad, but I did get some freeze.
On your toes?
Yeah.
The weather was certainly a hazard. And the way you just said it, I mean, that's certainly imposing. Don't fall asleep. You might not wake up. What were some of the other hazards that you had to watch out for? What are the different ways that you might not come home from the war?
Well, if you get in the way of a bullet, we had that 30 caliber and we had the mortar, so we were equipped. And I guess the gunners carried pistols and everybody else carried a rifle.
Do you remember the first time you got shot at?
We were on that hill I was telling you about. Mortar shells were coming over. They weren't shooting just at me.
But the fact that you were with that unit and that you're around this machine gun, that makes you a prime target.
Very much so.
You're the guys they want to take out. Did that register at the time? Were you aware of that?
You know, you're so busy at other things, you don't seem to bother you until you're through it.
In that time, from when you entered combat to when you got wounded, were there some other close calls that you came through where they almost got you?
Just the one out on the hill where we were at one night. It's probably about 3 o'clock in the morning.
Uh-huh. And what happened?
Well, those shells started coming at us. And if we'd struck the ground, which was frozen...
So did you have to go somewhere else? Or did you just hunker down?
Well, we just had to sit there and not dig.
And hope it didn't hit you.
Yeah.
How about dealing with guys around you being killed or wounded? How'd you handle that?
Well, we went into a town that had dead GIs stacked up like cordwood, 3 or 4 deep, maybe that high. Some of the characters were cutting rings off of dead guys' hands. My buddy, he didn't have the warm boots that we had, and I offered to take a pair off for somebody. He wouldn't wear them.
When you saw the dead Americans, you're going to get a pair of their boots and try to help save his feet.
Yeah.
What does that do to you when you're a 20-year-old kid and you see dozens of guys just like you are gone?
They were just laying there like stacked up like cordwood, about 3 foot tall, dozens and dozens of them.
Does that make you angry? Does it make you scared?
Sick.
Mm. And isn't there a point where it has to enter your mind? Maybe I'm next?
That's pretty much on your mind all the time.
How did you handle that? How did you keep going when that's confronting you constantly?
Kept reading my Bible and praying.
Were there times where you had to deal with losing someone you had gotten to know?
See, the outfit I was in, we were replacements, so I didn't know any of them really well. Now, when we were basic, you know, you knew the guys you were with all the time.
And, sure.
But when you go up as a replacement, you're the new guy. They're comfortable, so it doesn't get very close.
Maybe it's better that way.
I guess so. Well, you're just always worried about getting hit. Of course, they were running, and we were chasing. If it had been the other way around, it would have been worse. But they would leave booby traps, too.
Was that a frequent thing to encounter, a booby trap? Or?
Well, that's the only one I ever encountered.
Did you see some that had already gone off or guys that had been victimized by?
Well, heard of some. But if that one had gone off, there would have been about a half a dozen of us dead.
Wow. And you were inches away from triggering it.
I had my foot under the wire.
Your foot was touching the wire?
Under it.
Like, what, an inch or so?
Yeah. Wow. If I'd have moved my foot forward any, I would have tripped it off.
Wow. What kind of conditions did you have to sleep in? Did you have anything to keep you warm? Were you in a foxhole? Did you have a tent?
Usually we had a foxhole or some kind of cover.
Unless it was too frozen to dig in?
When I first got there, I was fixing a foxhole, and this guy come up and helped me. And I said, where do you guys get your socks? We get them the same place you do. He was the officer. No signals on him, though.
He didn't have the markings on his uniform?
No. They didn't wear them.
Because they didn't want to be targeted?
Yeah. Yep.
Did you find anything that would help you stay warm in those conditions? Extra clothing?
Well, when I got hit, I had on two overcoats and heavy gloves.
That was your standard?
It was that day. It's cold. I'd been on guard duty, and it was extra cold. And that shrapnel went right through there, half an inch layer, just took out bone and everything, nerves. And then on this other arm, it went through, took out the bone. So I had to have a bone graft, and it's broken.
So we understand. So you, and we talked about this a little bit, this was in the morning when this happened? And you and one other guy are standing next to each other?
Well, we're walking down to the Jeep with Mormite can in each hand.
Uh-huh.
That's what they brought the food in. Kept the food hot.
Right.
And it knocked me down.
Where did it hit in relation to where the two of you were?
It must have hit just in between us. We were not close together because you didn't dare do that. But as I went down, I lost my helmet down into a ditch. And I said to a couple of guys that were there, not ours, I didn't know them.
Mm-hmm.
I said, would you get my helmet for me? I lost it off in the ditch. And I was bleeding, of course, down the sleeves. And they said, you don't need a helmet. You need to get back to the aid station. They hailed a Jeep and got me back to the aid station.
What do you think would have happened to you if they didn't?
No telling. I'd have bled to death, probably.
So it lands between you, knocks you off your feet onto your stomach?
Yeah.
What did that feel like?
Well, it happens fast, you don't know.
You're kind of stunned and dazed?
It's just stunned.
Uh-huh. So it broke bones in your left hand, and that's bleeding.
And there was a little route across there, just a half inch deep.
So it took off the top of your hand.
When they went to do surgery, they scraped me all over, shaved me all over.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to hook up my hand to skin down here. When I woke up, a hand was like this and no skin. They had decided that they could press it back like that and sew it.
They bent your hand up,
yeah,
the wrist joint, and then stretched the skin to cover.
Yeah. My left arm was in a cast for 6 months.
And how about your right? Because it sounds like your right was pretty well.
For a year.
Was it shattered? Were all those bones shattered?
Yeah.
So you can't use either hand, either arm.
Not good. I'm down to 100% now, disabled.
And you had shrapnel in your backside, too.
Yeah, and it was just in the cheek Didn't get to the bone. Of course, I had the two overcoats on.
Yeah.
Time it got through them.
Were you in pain?
Yes. A funny thing. I got back to this aid station. They have what they call gray ladies. They're like our Red Cross.
Right.
And one of the gray ladies, they were older people, came and wrote a letter home for me. And the letter got home before the telegram got there.
And she has to write it for you because you can't write.
That's right.
You can't use your hands. So what did she write? You dictated for her?
Yeah, I told her what to say.
And this was to your wife or to your father?
To my wife.
What'd you tell her?
I told her, I said, I got hit, but I'll probably be back up on the front lines in a few days.
Likely story. What exactly would you be doing on the front lines?
I don't know.
Holding a spear in your mouth or something?
I was trying to keep it from her.
You're trying to reassure her so she doesn't worry. What did you really think?
I didn't think I'd ever be able to use my hands much.
Yeah.
You know what I ended up doing? Teaching typing.
Isn't that funny?
For 32 years.
Uh-huh.
Now I can't write again. I can't. See, this hand, this finger here has always been down like that.
Your index finger on your left hand.
Yeah, they never. But
it droops down.
I can type.
How many words a minute?
Well, I took a test at Fresno State when I went to summer school there. I got 80-some words a minute.
Whew.
That wasn't accuracy, but it was words.
We'll forgive a few typos at that speed. So you're wounded. They get you to an aid station. They stop the bleeding. They save your life.
Yeah.
Was there ever a time where you weren't sure you were going to live? Where you thought those injuries might take your life?
No, I didn't think so. I never thought like that.
And what about the guy next to you? What happened to him?
I don't know.
Never found out? So you mentioned having the gray lady write the letter for you.
Yeah.
That it got home before the telegram did. Did the telegram match your story?
Well, no.
I didn't think so.
But the funny part is the mailmen and mail people were, especially in out in the country, were very caring people. That telegram came, and he come to where my wife was, and he said, "Where's your mother?" "Well, she's over at Grandma's." Well, he said, "I've got to see her. You want to come with me and go over there?" So he took her over to Grandma's, and then he gave her the telegram.
So she'd have
someone. Because he didn't know the letter hadn't been there.
Right. He thought, this is breaking the news.
Yeah.
And she needs someone to give her a hug and console.
Yeah.
What did the telegram say? Just that you were wounded?
I didn't read it. Because I had a whole bunch of letters. They caught up with me after I got home.
So I'm just guessing, but you probably bounced around from a few different hospitals during all that time?
Well, we went, the first hospital was in France, Paris. And next, we went to England, and it was in the south part of England. I don't know the town, because I couldn't get out. And things like that weren't very important to me.
Yeah, and I'm just imagining there had to be a lot of uncertainty for you. I mean, what's life going to be like when you've got casts on both your arms?
At that time, somebody had to feed me. They brushed my teeth. They took care of the other details.
Yeah.
Everything. And that's not fun.
Probably changes your perspective quite a bit.
Yes. Well, I'm almost that way now. Outside of my head, everything else quit working. But so far, my brain's been in pretty good shape.
When you're in a situation like that, and you're only 20 years old, what gives you hope? What keeps you going to the next day? What makes you think that when you get home, your wife's going to want to still be with you?
Well, I just knew she was.
Yeah. I imagine every day was different. There were probably good days and bad days in the recovery. Did you have to learn how to move around again and how to control your body again?
Yeah. I couldn't walk.
Mm-hmm.
Even.
For how long?
Till I got back to the States. We were in New York for a short time. Then we went to Texas to a VA hospital. I had a half cast on this and a whole one on that. Everybody else was going home on leave, you know. I said, "When can I go?" He said, "When you learn to eat."
You had to be able to feed yourself.
I said, "Well, if you take that cast off and put a sleeve on there and wrap it where I can handle that fingers, I can feed myself." And I did. Within a week, I was feeding myself.
They took the half cast off your left hand, but they left the whole cast on
your right. Oh, yeah, it stayed on there right up to the time I was discharged.
And I'm guessing you weren't left-handed, right, until then?
Then I was.
Yeah. And I don't know how much they told you or how much you remember about what they had to do to give your arms a chance of working again. There must have been quite a few different procedures they had to do.
Well, in the first place, you see that hole in my arm?
Uh-huh.
They wrapped that with dry bandage and then put a cast on it for 30 days. And when they took the cast off, all that gauze was grown into the wound.
Uh-huh.
And it took quite a while soaking in the bathroom tub to get it off. And it still left the big... When I got discharged, they said, now, if you'd like to get that repaired, we can send you somewhere and get it repaired. I said, I like it just the way it is.
You had to be pretty thankful to be alive. And how long was it before you regained some function and where you could use both of your arms to some extent?
I got home, went to work in Dad's store, and every day I got asthma. And after 5 days, I talked to my buddy. I said, let's go to California. Oh, he said, I can't. I've got a job. Then when I went down to see him a couple of days later, he said, you still want to go to California? I said, yeah. Well, see, he was working for the railroad.
Uh-huh.
And a veteran came home and took his job back. So we came to California in one car, two pregnant women.
Been here ever since?
Yeah. My first job was digging stump holes for olive trees with a pick and shovel.
And with hands and arms that have been surgically repaired but would never again be at full strength. When we come back, we'll hear about how George Poplin overcame some of those challenges, how he followed up on that bargain he made with God on Christmas Eve of 1944, and we're even going to hear from one of his sons when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You hear a lot about World War II if you listen to Hometown Heroes, but have you ever wondered what it's like to be on a real World War II ship? The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of just two remaining operable Liberty ships, is docked at Pier 45 in San Francisco's famous Fisherman's Wharf. And the O'Brien is offering overnight programs on Fridays and Saturdays for kids ages 6 and up. Kids get to sleep on the ship in World War II bunks, have a private tour of the ship's galley, the crew quarters, guns and gun mounts, exhibits, and the crown jewel, the O'Brien's triple expansion steam engine. This is an experience like no other. For more details, call the SS Jeremiah O'Brien's office at 415-544-0100. That's 415-544-0100. Or visit the ship's website at ssjeremiahobrien.org.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with 93-year-old George Poplin, recorded with three generations of his descendants listening in at his son Dick's home in Fresno, California. We're going to hear briefly from Dick in a bit, and you may also hear the rest of that crew chuckling a time or two in the background along the way. You can find a photo of that group at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, where there's also a short video of George pointing out to us what shrapnel from a German mortar shell did to him along the Siegfried Line near Helenthal, Germany. We've heard how one arm was in a cast for 6 months, the other for a year, and that didn't mean he was fully recovered. The impact of injuries like those can really linger on.
We're talking February of 45. That's 72-plus years since this happened to you. How have those injuries affected you in all those years since?
Well, there are certain things I can't do with my arms, but I taught typing, which is a lot of fingers.
Yeah.
Did it for 32 years.
Where'd you teach?
Kerman High School.
Did your students ever know what you'd been through in the war?
Not especially.
Never talked about it?
Oh, they wanted to know what caused that.
Why your arms didn't look like somebody else's arms.
Yeah.
What'd you tell them?
I just told them the truth.
Yeah. You mentioned the woman who wrote a letter for you home to your wife. I imagine if you're in the hospital for a year, there are probably a lot of people that helped you, that did things for you that you couldn't do for yourself. Are there some other stories like that or other people that you still think about or you remember?
Well, there was this one fella who had a broken leg, and he didn't like to go to the cafeteria because that's where he broke his leg falling out of the steps. So I wasn't eating anything, sweet stuff. So when I got my plate of food, I ate the sweets off of it, and he ate the regular food. But he fed me.
Because you couldn't feed yourself.
He took me to the bathroom and brushed my teeth. It's a great thing.
What was his name?
Lige.
And he did this for quite a while?
Yeah.
He probably got out of there before you did.
I don't think so, because he got the cast off of his leg, went back to the cafeteria, and fell out of it again.
I guess he wanted to stick around you. He was having so much fun. And I understand that his name is one that is carried on in your family.
Yeah.
What's that story?
Well, I don't know. You know how it is when you got the name kids. Seems to be a difficult job.
Uh-huh.
We come up with Richard, and Lige is the middle name.
So your son's middle name is Lige because of that man who helped you.
Yeah.
What did it feel like to come home after all of that?
Wonderful.
But you didn't know where your wife was or what she was doing?
No.
You still hadn't heard from her, right?
No.
You'd written the letter, but you didn't know she got it.
Ah.
So how did that unfold?
When I got into New York City, I called and got a hold of her, talked to her. So I felt better after that.
I bet. So you called her when you got to New York, but then actually showing up in Oklahoma and seeing her again must have been something.
It was, very definitely. We had 40 good years, almost. She passed away on March the 7th, and marriage date was May 31st.
Were there ever days in the hospital where you weren't sure you were going to see her again, or you wondered what was going to happen there?
Not really.
Did you ever feel sorry for yourself or wonder, why did this have to happen to me?
No.
Why not?
I don't know. But I'm just not one that lets things get to me.
I imagine you saw quite a few other people who were in pretty bad shape, too.
One fellow had his hand, this whole part of it, just left his thumb. And we kid him about going back. He was from New York, going back there and getting a job as a policeman to direct traffic.
Were there other things that happened in that whole recovery time that you look back on and you say, boy, that really helped me?
No. See, we were in a ward with, I don't know, 10, 20 beds. So we all were pretty good friends and kind of kept people buoyed up.
Did you guys get updates on what was happening in the war?
Yes. And the day that Japan surrendered, I just turned over in the bed. I'd had surgery that day on my arm.
What did that mean to you, to hear that news?
Happiness. We started going to a Baptist church here in Fresno then in 49.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking with the pastor about coming in on the Queen. We came home on the Queen Elizabeth. And he said, well, about 10 days after you got home, I got on the Queen Elizabeth. And we were going to South Pacific. And the war ended.
Uh-huh.
They turned around and come back.
How about that? Did you sail into New York?
Yeah.
Did you see the Statue of Liberty?
Absolutely. Beautiful thing.
I imagine everybody was out on the deck to see that, huh?
They were. It's a beautiful sight.
You ever think back about that and what happened to you, the injuries you suffered, how close you came to being killed?
Just thank the Lord for being with me.
I mean, there's two kids and five grandkids and six great-grandkids who wouldn't be here.
That's right.
Anything else that whole experience taught you that you think people should know about?
You just have to take life as it comes at you.
Well, it came at you pretty hard that day.
Yeah, but it was coming at a lot of other people, too.
Did they give you the Purple Heart while you were still in the hospital?
Yeah. Oh, I also got the Combat Infantry badge.
Uh-huh.
After I was in the hospital. Well, it meant $10 a month more money.
That's right. Did somebody come and pin it on you?
Yeah. At the time, it didn't mean a whole lot, but it's meant a lot since then.
And I know you weren't over there very long.
Yeah.
Well, you were over there very long, just not in combat all that long. But what gives you pride today when you think back about yourself, the guys you served with, 16 million Americans in uniform, and what happened in World War II? What are you most proud of?
Well, I took care of Hitler. And in 1993, my second wife and I went with the Fresno Teachers Association, retired teachers, to Munster, Germany on their 1200th birthday. And I had lots of thoughts about going back to Germany, you know?
I bet.
But we got a family. We lived with family for 11 days. They couldn't have treated us any better. I mean, you'd thought we were the king and queen of England. Everything. He took us places his wife hadn't even been. Made a good feeling about Germany after that.
I know what I didn't do. I didn't say thank you. thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your story. Would you have any advice, any encouragement, any words to share with someone today? It's a different war, it's different weapons, it's different times, but there are guys coming home with similar injuries.
Yeah.
Is there something you would say for those folks or those families who are dealing with what you dealt with so many years ago?
Well, when I first come home, I couldn't do anything with my hands a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of cussed the Germans out for causing all that, but I got over that.
Was there something that helped you get over it?
Well, the best thing that happened was that trip we took to Germany.
It was cathartic for you? Let go of some of that animosity?
Yeah, very good.
And I assume that you took advantage of the GI Bill to go to college when you came back?
Absolutely.
And you went to school here, Fresno State? When did you graduate there?
52. The part where I promised the Lord I would serve him the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And we come to California, and I work in the fields, planting tomatoes, capping tomatoes, all those sort of things. And the day before Dick was born, I got a job with the union, laborers union, and I went to work with them. The next year, the guy asked me if I wanted to work for the bureau. I said, sure. And I went to work. My first check was $56. But 3 weeks later, they shut down the job, and the people working for the bureau, kept on. I got a salary all winter, and the other guys didn't. I took this test to see if I could better myself on the job. And the man said, you know, with your hands like in the shape they're in, you'll never be able to do hard labor the rest of your life. Said, do you ever think about being a school teacher? And I laughed. I said, my teachers would roll over in their grave if they knew I was going to teach. But in that same time, month, we moved to Fresno, enrolled at Fresno State. Dick was 2 years old. I went to school until February of 49, and we had never gone. We were saved down in Orange Cove at a mission of Mennonites, but I wasn't Mennonite, so you couldn't join the church, you know. Anyway, they said you probably would like to join a Baptist church somewhere. So we moved here in 49, 6 months after I got here. We were having a little squabble on Sunday morning. My wife said, you should be in church. I said, well, I know where there is one because I pass it every day on my way to school. And it's First Southern Baptist Church downtown. And we went, joined the church later, and I've been there ever since.
Almost 70 years.
I had 47 years as treasurer and about that many years as a deacon. Now all I do is sit at the door and hand out bulletins.
That's all?
I get a kick out of that, and so do the people, really.
I bet they do.
I get lots of hugs.
I wonder if you might get a few more after this is on the radio. They're going to want to come meet you. Now they know where to find you.
Do people listen to the radio?
You'll find out on the next Sunday morning, I guess. You can tell the whole church to listen.
Okay.
They'll love that whiskey story.
I should have left that one out.
Anything else you remembered?
No, that was the part I wanted to tell.
I'm glad you did. You kept up your end of the bargain, huh?
Yeah.
And I guess he kept his, too?
He sure has.
I got one more question for you. I don't know if it's an easy one to answer. You got a couple of your great-grandsons sitting right here listening. And most of us alive today, we didn't live through World War II. We don't know what it was like, what it was all about, how all-consuming it was.
Well, living in Oklahoma, we didn't know either until, you know, really.
So what do you think we need to know today? What do we need to understand and remember about World War II and what you and all those other people did?
Remember that they did a good thing, that it wasn't easy, took a lot of stuff out of them.
Was it worth it?
Well, I suppose it must have been.
We hear the number a lot, especially on this program. 406,000 Americans died while serving in World War II. But so many more were wounded and came home. Physical wounds like yours. Psychological wounds, too. People are still haunted by that.
Yeah, they are.
You ever deal with any of that yourself?
Nope.
Good. Is there anything we should know about what you've had to deal with physically all these years because of those injuries that you suffered on our behalf?
Just a lot of things I couldn't do with my hands.
Did you still arm wrestle your sons?
No. I was very careful with my arms. I wouldn't even go skating.
So if your son wanted to go outside in the yard and throw the ball around?
Oh, yeah, we did that. In fact, that's how I broke this arm. They did a bone graft, and I couldn't move my wrist.
Uh-huh.
But I threw a ball, and it twisted my wrist, and that bone snapped.
Ouch.
And so after that, I could move my wrist.
There's your silver lining, huh?
I went to a doctor here in Fresno, and he said, if you don't get that arm fixed within 5 years, your arm's going to shrivel up and you won't be able to use it. I said, I'll see you in 5 years. And it made it a lot longer than that. He died and I didn't.
Still going at 93 and serving as an inspiration to those people who grab a bulletin from those aging hands at church or hear the folksy charm and resilient spirit in his voice. George's son Dick has heard that voice his entire life, and in the time we have left, let's get a little perspective from Dick on growing up with a father whom World War II left wounded and disfigured, but never defeated.
I don't really remember thinking that he was any different than any other dad. The one thing he threw underhand when we played catch, he didn't throw overhand, so that was different, and I knew he had an arm problem, but he didn't really tell us much about the war, didn't really realize everything that happened to him during that war. I do say I want to say to you, Dad, that we do appreciate your sacrifice in the war and all the other veterans that gave their life and just served in the war to provide us with the freedoms that we have today. And we don't want to forget that, and we want to remember the sacrifice that you paid so that we could have these freedoms, and we thank you for that.
Have you ever imagined yourself in his shoes and wondering how you would have handled going through what he went through?
Yes, I have, and I guess you don't really know how you'd handle it until you actually go through something like that, but I have wondered what I would have done.
Yeah, and your life was on the line there too.
This is true. He never lets anything get him down. He has such an upbeat attitude and about everything, even the things later in life here that he's had gone wrong physically that have put him in the wheelchair, and he takes everything in stride, and that impresses me, and I pray that I'd be able to do the same thing.
Amen to that. If only all of us could face difficulties with that same persevering spirit that George Poplin has displayed for all these years. We're out of time for now. Don't forget to check out the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Until next time, I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you of that truth underscored so powerfully through this wounded veteran story today. Freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org.
Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.